Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast titled Managing Power and Connectivity in Directed Energy Weapons. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Open Systems Media and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Carl Kitt, Senior Manager Engineering for TE Connectivity, Bruce Conway, Scientist for TE Connectivity, and Matt Macalonis, Engineering Fellow with TE Connectivity. Carl has been a Senior Engineering Manager for the High Performance Group within the Aerospace, Defense, and Marine Business Unit of TE. In this role, is responsible for new product development, program project management, as well as sustaining engineering activities for signal level relays, power contactors, power distribution systems, sensors, and ruggedized fire optics. He started his career in 1986 with Hartman Electrical Manufacturing, which was later acquired by TE. He was an engineering manager with Eaton Corp Aerospace Controls prior to joining TE in 2003. He's also served in leadership roles with SAE for aerospace standards development for more than 20 years. Carl received his bachelor's in engineering from Ohio University with an MBA from Auburn University. Bruce Conway, the scientist with TE Connectivity, earned a BS in applied physics from HSU in 1986. He has more than 20 years of experience in the fields of fiber optics, electronics, mechanical design, thermal management, and energy moderators. Bruce spent 9 years in the Raychem Corporate Technology Advanced Developer Group, followed by 10 years in startups designing Metro DWDM systems and microfluidic cooling systems for computers. He also managed the system integration of flow battery designs. Bruce is currently a scientist within the Aerospace, Defense, and Marine Wire Development Group of TE. Matt Macalonis has a degree in mechanical engineering and is an experienced innovator and engineering leader with more than 25 years supporting customers with high connectivity solutions. He's a subject matter expert for advanced defense and military VPX products, high-speed embedded computing, rugged connectivity, aerospace and defense applications. He holds 49 issued U.S. patents in connectivity-related technology, black belt certification, and lean design for Six Sigma, and has issued 13-plus technical papers and industry presentations. Now, before we get started, I have some housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. The webcast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Regarding your viewing console, which may be new to some of those of you who are familiar with Open Systems Media webcasts, it has some important new features I'm going to quickly run through. The console consists of a set of windows that you can close, open, move, resize, and maximize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see a picture of our presenter in the presenter window, biography in the speaker bio window, the presentation slides in the slides window, and a Q&A window, which enables you to ask questions during the event. There are a set of 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking the icon on the far left will reset your viewing area to the default configuration. The rest of the icons will open or close their corresponding window. You can hover your mouse over each window to show which window it controls. The handout icon third from the right opens the handout window, which has presented slides in PDF format. You can use to follow along or download for future reference. The Q&A window enables you to participate in today's event. Simply type a question into the Ask Question text box and then hit Submit. If you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will get back to you during the webcast. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event while the question is still fresh in your mind. We'll address as many questions as we can during the closing Q&A session. And please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. Today's webcast will be archived online at the URL shown on your screen and be available within 24 to 48 hours. Once up, it'll be available for 1 year. Now let's get it started, and our first speaker today is going to be Matt. Matt Macalonis, take it away.
Thanks, John, and thanks, everybody, for joining today. Could we have the next slide, please? There you go. Thank you. So today we're talking about power and connectivity. There's some of the photos of the speakers today. Matt Macalonis is me. I'm on the left. Bruce is in the middle and Carl on the right. Next slide, please. So our agenda. Today I'm going to give a brief overview of TE Connectivity, and then we'll get into what is directed energy weapons and talk about the relevance today with connectivity. And Bruce is going to get into some of the challenges we have technically and what we're working on overcoming. And then Carl will get into some of the power contactors, relays, and sensors that are involved in some of this architecture. And then I'm going to wrap it up with some of the high power connectivity solutions that we have at TE. And we'll follow that up with some Q&A. Thanks. So a little bit about T connectivity. So if you haven't heard about T connectivity, it's a Fortune 500 company that is over $13 billion in sales. And we have our company divided up into three major segments, the largest being the transportation, which is highly into the automotive sector. And the main area that all of us work on the webinar today is in our industrial, and we work in the aerospace and defense sector, which is about $4 billion. And the smaller section of our company is our telecom and communication sector, which is just under $2 billion. But everything in our world today is connected, and we're involved with pretty much every aspect of our daily lives with connectivity. Next page. And we're global, so it doesn't matter where you are. We have locations that span in the Americas, in the European regions, and also in the Asian regions. So we have a nice distribution of our employee base, our product manufacturing sites, so we can really be close to our customers and work with you on our solutions. In the aerospace and defense sector, that's highly what we're going to talk about today, is in the European and Americas region, and that's where all three of us are located. You may have heard of some of our brands. So the product brands that we make include the wire and cable products like Raychem, the interconnects of AMP and Deutsch, some of the back shells like we have with Plamco, and harnessing products. So we have a lot of things you may not know the name T connectivity, but what's labeled on our products, Microdot, Raychem, C-Con, those are some of the things. Hartman and Kilovac are the relay brands. So we have many, many different kinds of products, not just copper, so high power, also in the fiber optics and sensors and harnessing and back shelves. We also make value-add solutions, which are some of the subsystems that go into our end users' products. So we're going to next talk about directed energy weapons. So I'm sure everyone has heard or seen movies like Star Wars and Star Trek and some of the things that they do with lasers and some of the particle beams and so forth in the science fiction world. On the right, you'll see a picture of one of the CTOs that works under the Secretary of Defense, Michael Griffin, and he's made a comment recently about directed energy is where we want to go in the long run, and we see a lot of development right now in this area. So that's why we're talking about them, and they have become a reality in our world today. So what are they? They're high-focus energy beams. Obviously, the lasers are probably the ones that first come to mind, but there's other types, which are some RF or microwave, particle and plasma beams, sonic weapons, and these are used for a lot of different purposes. Some of the advantages of these is you can't hear them, or sometimes you may not even see them. So there's a tactical advantage when you have that attribute. And traditional weapons are affected by things like gravity and wind. And when you need to have a very, very precise target and put a laser beam on that, you're traveling at the speed of light and not affected by some of those effects. You could also think about if you have a constant power generation, you can typically have an unlimited ammo supply. So you can have continuous pulsing of these devices. And also, you can have non-lethal ways you can use this. So if you can envision maybe a sonic weapon that has a noise where you can have a very piercing noise that will hopefully immobilize your threat and not have to harm them in a lethal way. Next slide. So we have a couple pictures of some of the actual ways we're seeing these in use. So one of the ways we can use these on the far left is an example of a C-130, and you can see a green dot on the beneath side of that, and that is a gimbal with a laser, and that can put a laser on targets either to do targeting or to disable, for example, a missile it can target, or maybe a truck or a vehicle on the ground it can target and disable those threats. We also have land-based ones, as seen on the truck, where you can have a significant advantage there with a generator on the ground that doesn't have to fly around, and you can put your laser beam on another target, maybe in the air, like a missile. Or the far right shows a ship where you can have maybe an incoming threat that comes in. And these are all examples of portable and mobile platforms that can move around. They can also look at long range. And one of the threats today that you often hear about, especially when you see on the news with North Korea and things like that, where people are sending missiles, sometimes for tests, sometimes for attack. But we can have platforms like this that can help us defend some of our assets. Next slide, please. Next slide shows some of the active programs. So these are some of the programs that actually have funding, and there are different companies you've heard of, like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and these are some of the ones that you can see spans equipment on the ground, equipment up in space, and I'm sure you've all heard about the new Star and Space Force initiatives. And so these are some of the types of programs. The one thing you'll see on here is the amount of power required for high energy weapons. So some of these lasers are more than 100 kilowatts. And when you think about some of these types of power with current and voltage needed, then the next question we have to ask is, how do we enable this type of technology in these applications? When you're on the ground, you have certain atmospheric conditions that you can establish some of these high power, but once you actually get into altitude, you see other physics take effect with the different densities of air, and that's what Bruce is going to talk about next. So I'm going to turn it over to Bruce, and he's going to get into some of the main technical challenges that we get into with some of the cabling designs that work in these systems. Go ahead, Bruce.
Good morning, everyone. The some of the design issues talked about today, dielectric breakdown, coronal discharge, skin and proximity effects. If you notice, what isn't on there is current handling capability. Those are items that you are just generally calculate from the for the materials when you do the design. These are issues that pop up that will cause failure. So just to start with talking about dielectric breakdown, just the definition of it in a dielectric, it's at the point where the dielectric will go into conduction. When this happens, usually on power feeders, this is an extraordinarily destructive event. As you can see here in the picture that's posted, this is from one of our test sets, and that was from 150 kVA discharge. It went through two layers of fuselage there in this case. So one of the big, big issues is during use of these energy weapons, you're at oftentimes operating at very high currents, very high voltages, and you cannot afford to have a breakdown such as this. It'll completely disable the weapon. Now, just to show you what put things in magnitude for breakdown, using an example here, we have 1 millimeter of insulation, say next to a ground plane at 48 volts. You wind up with just 48 kilovolts per meter. It sounds fairly high, but actually that's extremely low. Doesn't really present much challenge. Most insulations will carry that. Now, you're going to be powering these weapons usually with very high power, so you very high voltages, so you minimize your ohmic losses. So you're now, say, at 1,000 volts. You're for the same wire. You're now at a megavolt per meter for your gradient. And this is going to stress the dielectrics. Just to compare for dry air, say an air gap 1 millimeter at 1 atmosphere will have a breakdown of 3 kV. And if you look over there to your right, there's a graph there of Panshin's law showing what happens to gases as you rarefy it. Now, as Matt mentioned, as you go up in altitude, you have issues. And one of the problems is this, that the breakdown for gases lowers. And that leads to another phenomenon for partial discharge I'll talk about in a minute. But for us to increase the breakdown voltage, you can use any number of high-performance polymers. Now, this chart here is just commercial values for this. And one of the main ones we use for the aerospace industry is PTFE. It has very good mechanical properties, and you can use a relatively thin layer. We have to deal with something oftentimes in aerospace called SWAP, size, weight, and power. And so we're always looking to be able to use materials that allow us to minimize those items. Let's see, next slide, here we go. Now, as I mentioned, partial discharge. Partial discharge, one of the problems people do confuse these two. Partial discharge is a phenomenon by which the field gradient becomes high enough around a conductor that it will start to liberate electrons from the gas. When that happens, those electrons cascade. As they cascade, they liberate more electrons, generating an ionization around conductors. Now, there doesn't have to be any physical contact. This just takes place in open air. And there's two types of currents. One is ionic current, and one is electron current. The electrons don't have a lot of kinetic energy, so it's not very important. The ionic one, however, the ions will bombard a surface, and the damage that's incurred is purely of a ballistic nature, while with dielectric breakdown, this is actually a cascade where it starts to conduct. And when it starts to conduct, the material is destroyed. In this case, there's slow accumulative damage that happens from bombardment. From the graph that you saw a minute ago, you can see that it's highly dependent on altitude. At around 45,000 feet or so, you will reach a minimum point, and that is your worst case for coronal discharge. Now, just for frequency dependence, the behavior is fairly simple for it below about half a megahertz, which is where almost all power things operate. This may be an exception in, say, some of the pulse weapons like the rail cannons that are starting to be developed. They're extremely high pulse, very short duration, and you may be forcing wires into corona because of that. If you do, since they are very short duration, depending on the erosion rate, you may actually be able to operate within corona for short durations. Just to put it in perspective, a wire that may last 30,000 to 50,000 hours out of corona, in corona may have a lifetime as short as 20 hours. That's the ratio approximately for the lifetimes, and it is astonishing how quickly this material will erode if it's operating in corona. Now, this is a standard graph that's used, and I do apologize for the quality of this graph. This has been reprinted from a paper originally published in 1937, and this is the industry standard that's used for calculating partial discharge breakdown for what's called equivalent thickness. But you can see on the graph there's a number of lines for various altitudes, and again for breakdown voltage versus equivalent thickness. For low frequencies, the behavior actually follows this quite closely, which is why this graph has been used for so long. Now, managing partial discharge, again, talking about worst case scenario, about 50,000 feet, we have most feeders, operating at ranges around 800 volts or requiring at least 800 volts minimum breakdown. They're operating usually at around 600 volts or so for normal operation, and up to 400 hertz for most aerospace applications. Now, again, for these types of weapon systems, you're talking about very, very high either impulses or sustained demands. So you're talking about having to go quite a ways up in voltage, so in many cases up to 10 kV or higher, which will raise this issue. Now, if you're a simple solution is to simply increase the thickness of the dielectric. And there are other things you can do, like screening it by putting semiconducting layers and such things in, just to manage the field gradient. But as long as you're not having to worry about weight, just a thicker insulation, and minding the termination so at sharp points you don't have initiation, is usually sufficient. If you do have to reduce weight, like say, you have to go to some more exotic things, such as either doing materials that can endure or having to do layering. Now, the next thing to talk about, these are one of two magnetic effects that take place. Now, as you go up in frequency, there are surface eddy currents that develop on all conductors. As a result, it sets up magnetic fields along the conductor, and this literally pulls current away from the central part of the conductor. The equation that governs it is displayed there. Won't go into too terribly much depth on it, but needless to say, it doesn't take a lot to start losing cross-section. We're in many efforts now trying to make power feeders that operate at power frequencies of 2 to 3 kilohertz. And here's just the example showing you where the what's called the 100% cutoff. This is when you actually wind up with a dead zone in the middle. If for, say, an ought feeder, it is only around 206 hertz. And this is for copper. And for a double ought, it's 206 hertz. For an ought, it's 277 hertz. Anything above that, you're starting to lose cross-section, in which what it means is you're going to have to deal with ohmic heating of the wire with increasing severity with the frequency going up. Now, you may say you're going to operate below 2 or 3 kilohertz. Well, a lot of ways that power is being synthesized now, say from DC battery plants and such, is using IGBT switching packs. Those have switching frequencies of up to 20 kilohertz. Now, you're synthesizing a sine wave, but you're relying on the inductive and capacitive loading of the system to smooth that out. So you still have the high frequency components. Those high frequency components will be traveling on the outside of the skin, and they can account for 5 or 10% of the total power. So say if you're doing 500 kilowatts, you may be dealing with, you know, 50 kilowatts or so of power that is now on the skin and will cause heating. So it is, for high power systems, something you need to consider, even if your base frequency is lower. The noise, which is a substantial fraction of the power, has to be considered. Now, this is another magnetic effect, and this one's a little more complicated. In the first magnetic effect, the skin effect, it's always symmetrical, or almost always symmetrical, depending on how your wire core is designed. This is called proximity effect, and this has to do with the magnetic fields interacting between adjacent conductors. Now, in this diagram here, this is showing how current concentrates towards the outside. This is oftentimes occur in three-phase systems. The current gets pushed to the outside. Now, it does depend on the phase relationship. In some cases, the current may actually get pulled towards the middle rather than forced away, depending on the phase relationship. This can occur very commonly in three-phase system. It's something that always has to be taken into account in terrestrial systems or submarine cables. The usual way of handling it is simply introducing a little space between the conductors. There are other ways of handling it with introducing ground members and other such things. But the big problem with this effect is that it is very dependent on the geometry of the finished cable. So if you put a cable through a bend, you may wind up with a hot spot that was unexpected. And again, in these systems, when you're talking about, you know, tens or hundreds of kilowatts going through a system, one of those bends could cause a localized heating to the point of causing insulation damage and eventually leading to breakdown. The spacing can be done. You also run into this problem even in single-phase systems where you have the feed and return. If you put a feed and return right next to each other, this is one of the cases on the load. It depends on, again, how the phase stays between the two, that you may end up actually forcing the current towards rather than away. Now, we are looking at some other exotic things, such as modified cross sections. That's nothing really new. The power industry has been doing that since about 1900, using triangular sections and such. It's all a matter of trying to manage how the current is forced around in the conductor. Now, yeah, just a quick summary. Proper handling of high voltage required to prevent dielectric breakdown. This means both managing your correct selection of type of insulation, thickness of insulation, and also one thing that oftentimes gets neglected, the mounting of the cables is very important to prevent abrasion, to prevent localized heating. Again, very dependent on the system whether or not it is steady state or you're doing impulses, again, like a rail cannon. For corona, and corona is a quick killer. This is one, if you're going to operate in high voltage, you need to consider either corona-proof or resistant materials. Corona-resistant material literally meaning that you're raising the inception voltage. Corona-proof, this is something that people are asking a lot about. It presents a lot of technical challenges because you have to have a material that can literally withstand the ballistic bombardment of the ions, and it's not an easy task. And then finally, again, managing of the magnetic effects of both proximity and skin effect for these high power systems. And I'll hand it back over to you, Carl.
Thank you, Bruce. And thanks, everybody, for joining today. Again, I'm Carl Kitz from the HPG Group of Aerospace Defense Marine. If I can advance the slide here. Today, my talk will focus on power contactors and more specifically high-voltage DC contactors and solid-state power controllers that are being used for power distribution control, really for the next generation warfighters or directed energy platforms. We'll talk a bit about technologies and the trends that we see that we're facing for today and in the future. First, a little bit about contactors and basic contact physics. In the illustration on the bottom right there, you can see a typical construction of one of our brands of what in the industry are known as kilovac brand contactors, high voltage DC contactors. Probably most on the phone already know that contactors are basically just high current relays used to directly switch large power loads. They're often the primary means of protection in the event of a fault, and that is compared to signal level or lower level relays where they're typically used in series with a secondary circuit protection device such as a fuse or a circuit breaker. Most contactors are electromechanical in nature. They use a magnetic actuator, either of a solenoid type as shown on the top there, or a box frame, which is kind of in the middle. And either one of those are doing really the same functionality. They establish a magnetic field across that open contact gap. And in that gap is where the magic happens. We create attraction and motion. And we use that to translate or move a contact set into the open and close of the main power switch. These are usually single pole devices as shown for, if we talk about aerospace or military ground vehicle, for 28 volt applications or high voltage DC, they're usually single pole products. Multiple poles, very common in mainline switches for the AC side, obviously for 115 or 230 volt AC, using largely the same principles. In an AC contactor, we can take advantage of the waveform current zero crossing. That's when we extinguish the arc in an AC part. In 28-volt DC, it doesn't take a whole lot more than just a double break contact set. We basically interrupt with that. We don't have to rely much on the arc control in a 28-volt part. But in 270-volt high-voltage contactors and higher voltages, it's much more of a challenge. So here, more about, we'll talk about contact surfaces directly. Really, regardless of how flat we think we have a contact surface or how finely polished that surface may be, or even the cross-sectional areas of that surface, the contact interfaces are really quite small. We call those A-spots or anode spots. And the overall collective size of those A-spots is a function of the contact material hardness and how hard we press those contacts together, and that comes from the force of the actuator. So those A-spots initially are basically just peaks which make contact on multiple surfaces of the contact. And they start to expand until the yield strength of the raw material, or the contact raw material, matches that of the applied actuator force. So that's our initial position. Current flow is established in the contact set. Heat from that contact interface will also warm the contacts, and often quite significantly, in those A-spot diameters will start to enlarge. People that apply power contactors are aware of this. You will notice that sometimes it can take a few seconds after closure for you to get your really the lowest point of on resistance, and that's because of the heating of the contacts and those A-spot diameter increases. So in contacts, we have to strike a balance between those soft materials, like fine silver material that is very somewhat ductile and can be compressed more easily and have larger spot diameters for lower on resistance, but that can be sacrificed in the event of arcing. If you have a very tough load, highly inductive load, a lot of energy, we go to harder contact materials, but they often have a trade-off with on resistance. There are designs where we make use of two unique contact materials where we can make on one a hard contact set and then carry on a softer, lower on resistance contact set for the long haul. Okay, now we talk about what happens, when we need to interrupt. So as the contact force relaxes, the contacts are, they're changing state from that solid or in some cases even welded condition back to open. So as we lose the contact force, that contact interface begins to heat and it becomes molten on the contact surfaces. At that final separation, that current density in those arc columns or A spots is now very large, and we form a bridge of contact material, molten contact material. They'll eventually vaporize and we initiate an arc between the contact sets. We are quite fond of those arcs. They actually are a very graceful transition from an on state to an off state without abrupt voltage escalation and some of the other things that can happen with a quick off of stored energy. So as the contacts separate further, we build voltage in that arc column. The arc cools in the air, and we start to build resistance in the arc. Voltage drop is increasing. once that arc voltage gets high enough that it matches the source voltage and the any contribution from the stored energy of the circuit inductance, whatever, that is when we have interruption. Now, and that's pretty easy for low voltage. When you get into high voltage DC, it can be very difficult to make that happen. You got to continue to stretch the arc, and you're relying more on the voltage of that arc column than just, you know, having a make and break in the anode and cathode. By calculation, you know, a 270 volt and higher arc in under ideal conditions, you could stretch that thing to 2 to 3 inches in length before you get enough voltage to interrupt. And it's obviously not practical to make a contactor with a 3-inch stroke and to try to deal with the gas energy for that kind of thing. So what do? You try to stretch the arc or break that arc into series arcs as shown on the left. So you can, it's fairly common in transit systems, for example, that you'll series up contact sets to increase the voltage withstand capability. Or you can blow that arc into splitting plates or stretch it into a labyrinth arc shoot to increase that arc voltage. We also use permanent magnet blowouts to control that arc to get it to go where we want it to go, or some people use blowout coils, for example. In high voltage DC, we also control the atmosphere, so we have a cooling atmosphere inside the part we maintain, and then the sealing of that vessel builds the pressure during the interrupt that also helps to interrupt the current. A little bit about, you know, like I say, our product brands, the Kilovac brand was our high voltage DC brand, was an independent at one time and then an acquisition of TE Connectivity. It started really as glass, almost like vacuum tube relays back in the 70s, and for very high voltage, up to 70,000 volts, for example. In the 1980s, the need for power switching and came about from like the space station applications and F-22. For those glass sealed vessels were changed over to ceramic enclosures with typical of brazing and metallized end caps and seals. Those were known as, in the top picture you'll see there, those were known as Bubbas and Zonkas and Spuds and some other things are the names that those contactors had. In the late 90s, the Kilovac guys who really struck on an innovation of the ability to accomplish the level of sealing of a ceramic or a glass vessel in plastics with epoxy seals. So most all of the newer contactors that are for high voltage DC use that kind of construction. And now they have equivalent parts that are much more, much lighter, smaller, and more affordable than the old glass and ceramics. The latest Kilovac product brands here, you'll see some examples, but they're all these epoxy sealed versions. For example, the CAP 120 there, second from the left, that's a 150 amp, 600 volt contactor it's only an inch and a half in diameter and an inch and a half tall. It's very incredible the amount of switching energy that can happen in that part. KHR 500, 600 amp part, that's a part that we refer to as Bubba 2, so it's a direct replacement for that old ceramic Bubba contactor that's much more attractive in terms of size and weight. K1K in the middle, that is a really high power product, 1,000 volt, 1,000 amp contactor that's used not only from directed energy applications, but also some others in electric propulsion and solar and some other interests. Finally, the KCS on the right, those are the high voltage contactors coming in a couple of current ratings, but they include a current sensor. So they have a Hall effect current sensor that senses running current through the part, and it can be used either just for monitoring or for actual I2P overcurrent protection. So you can add a trip curve to that part and have it act. There's no hundreds of amps, 270 volt circuit breaker, so the contactor itself will act as a circuit breaker. Also, people are obviously doing solid state power controllers for high voltage DC. There are ours and there are others out there. These are a couple versions we offer, which are a 125 amp or a 250 amp solid state power controller. So these have advantages of no moving parts, no wear out mechanisms. And they're using silicon carbide substrate power switches. They have some interesting features that overcurrent protection is baked into these. So they have their own trip curve naturally. They also have integrated precharge in a lot of high voltage applications. The current surge when you have capacitive front ends on a motor controller or some other type of power conversion can be pretty extreme. So they have precharge that can control that inrush. Also, they can communicate. So they have a data bus communication. Directed energy. So I talked about the 1,000 volt, 1,000 amp. This is our K1K product. We have specialized versions of the K1K for both directed energy and electric propulsion interest. Generally, the heat generation just due to on resistance when you're talking about a 1,000 amp part can be pretty extreme. So we do things here that to lower voltage drop to be significantly lower in proportion than it would be for lower current parts. So, we're talking about 50, 60 millivolt drops at 1,000 amps because that's what you can tolerate in a power panel, for example. So the baseline product is a 2 kiloamp fault or interrupt capability, although we have versions of that can do, if the application requires it, 4K or up to 6,000 amps of fault current. Finally, kind of closing, what do we see trends in terms of power contactors and high voltage distribution? Commercial aerospace, certainly environmental regulations drive us to do more, go beyond just more electric aircraft. So it gets much more beyond just changing over hydraulics to electric actuation, for example. It's full electric propulsion is coming. Switch gear, like the contactors, are just a part of the story. We also, have to have more efficient and smaller, lighter energy storage batteries, power sources. A lot of the prior rules for design, you got to reconsider in these applications, that you may not be able to use a part that is designed at all times for the coffin corners of performance just because it's size and weight prohibitive. In military applications, in direct energy applications, what we really need to think about is just how to react to the transient and survive the transient and continue to function. We talk about 1 kV today. We're confident that 2 kV, 3 kV, and even perhaps 4 kV are coming down the road. We can handle that inside the contactors. You know, we control our atmosphere inside there. So inside the contactor, we don't have to worry too much about corona, for example. But when we get on the outside terminals, we certainly do. Finally, health and usage monitoring that, you know, we always had consideration of that for mechanical systems like landing gear and such. But here we're going to have to take it on board ever more seriously for the electrics because, active insulation monitoring and systems like that are become more and more critical. That's the end of mine. I think I hand it back to Matt at Ford to talk about interconnect.
Thanks, Carl. Okay, so now we're going to get into how do you connect these power switching devices, and I have a picture here of a way to do that. So often we'll have copper terminals. These are terminals designed for aerospace, and we have, depending on the need, we have copper terminals, aluminum terminals. Aluminum obviously is a lot lighter, and the copper terminal is thinner, so it takes up less space. But everything in between, including as Bruce covered the power feeder cables, we make those in copper and aluminum. The tubing that can go over to protect it, feed throughs. If you're going through a bulkhead from one compartment to another, you know, how do you do that and seal those things from the environment? And if you ever have abrasion on a cable, how do you repair it? So there's a lot of things that are in between, including the connectors and cables. Some of the ones that I'll just quickly go through are what we call the Copplume Light. So these are products that can be applied to either copper or aluminum cable, and you see a lot of different types of terminals depending on what you're connecting to, whether it's a terminal block or a relay. The feed-through is in the upper right, the black connector, so you'll see how that is applied. It's a very interesting kind of a clamshell that comes on both sides of the cable and then seals a bulkhead. And then we have a lot of connectivity options, which are either power or hybrid power and signal. So on the left, you see some of our Deutsch brand product, and on the right, you see some of our Plomco 1,000 volt product there. Starting with the terminals, so these are on the end of the wire. They're sealed, so there is no water ingress between the insulation into the cable itself. So that's really important for environmental protection, especially if you're coming off of a generator on an engine that could be exposed to the environment. So these are some aluminum versions. So we have literally decades of history on this stuff from the crimp and the terminal in this for commercial aerospace. So these are the ones, if you fly on an airplane, you're flying these products today. So we have lightweight versions to help with fuel economy and savings. And when you see the different styles and derivatives, so we can enable any type of configuration and application. What's special about these new terminals made out of aluminum is significant weight savings for fuel economy. The crimps are very, very good, proven, and stable. We do very severe testing with them, from shock and vibration, the things like sky draw and de-icing fluids to make sure they're compatible with that. And so these are the ones that are used for the high power applications for directed energy and other power generation. There are many different sizes, from smaller gauge, you know, power 10 gauges is relatively small, up to a 4-aught type. And again, many different styles depending on what the end use is for the product. when you go from one section of a vehicle or an aircraft to another, often this will be sealed environments, and you don't want ingress coming through that through a cable. Traditionally, we can pot this. Sometimes that can take a whole day before you can make it usable. The Deutsch D-Easy is a very unique product that you can apply simply under 15 minutes. You can do it on an aircraft in a typically confined spaces on either side. And here's a good schematic here that shows how the components go together, both the seals and all the components, even the threaded components are very, very simple to assemble. And this is a nice product when you're taking these big power cables routed through some of these types of vehicles. What's on the other end of that can be a connector. So here are just some of the types of connectors where you see from size 4 through 300 amp size double aught contacts. And you can see some of the configurations are hybrids with power and signal. All these are designed to be used in harsh environments and a lot of the applications you'll see for directed energy. And this is where we get into some of the single conductor connectors that can take us up to 1,000 amps. So this is our Plamco high power in the 3999 style connectors. So there's many different sizes and shell sizes. We can use these for different types of interconnect locking and high vibration environments. Here's another example of a feed through where you can take a terminal applied to this device here for a single pole. These are often used in some of the military vehicles. Again, 1,000 amp rating on these products. When you think about some of the new trends, as Carl mentioned, hybrid vehicles, high voltage are things you're seeing it with electric cars. This is some of the other type of content that we work on at TE that can be adapted to other harsh environments. In many cases, you need to make sure you enable maintenance and safety. So many of these new cables are coated with an orange color to make sure the maintainer is aware that there could be high voltage and dangerous voltages inside of the box. So there's a lot of new standards coming out, but generally we're seeing more and more voltage from 600 and above 1,000 volt type of applications and requirements from our customers. We also have ones that are designed to be used in very, very hot environments, including engines. So some of the ones you see here, like the EN2997 engine connector, actually has to pass a fire test where if an engine catches on fire, it will survive that test for a certain duration. So K-Series is another 3999 that is involved with those types of applications and tests. But key takeaway here is some of the high temperature with high energy discharge applications, we have products that can be used in those environments. So the last part of our presentation today, we would like to open it up to Q&A. So I'm going to turn it back over to John, and he will lead that part of the session today.
Thanks, Matt. Great presentation, all three of you. Really well done. Let's get some questions. I've got a question here from the audience. What is the impact on power feeders by extreme battlefield environments? Does not assign, so any one of you guys want to take it?
Let's see, I can handle that one. Well, as mentioned, a lot of the failure modes that occur in cables are, you know, things such as dielectric breakdown or corona. Contaminants of many sorts can lead to failure of these types of cables. It's very important to, as Matt presented with some of these termination techniques, that sealing becomes paramount to avoid having these types of contaminants. Also, you need to consider explosive atmospheres. You need to consider altitude. These are all extreme environments. The other thing, too, is you need to consider battlefield repair. A lot of wires, say, especially use ETFE and things, there aren't normally methods for just patching that wire. We do sell some specialized patch kits that will fuse to those types of insulations. So it is a big consideration. I understand over reading history of military operations that there's been many times where a weapon has been designed. It's been a beautiful weapon. The moment it gets into the field, dirt, water, and such just completely render it non-functional. You need to consider what the exposures are going to be for a particular system ahead of time.
Thank you. Next question from the audience. Was there a second ago? Let's see if I find it. Yes. Sometimes designers use contractors to break fault curtains that can be a couple times larger than what the base rating of the contactor is. In your SS products, are those being designed with similar overcurrent breaking capabilities?
Hi again, it's Carl Kitz. Yeah, question I believe in regard to the solid state power controllers, and the answer is yes. That the difference in a solid state power controller, however, is the intelligence and the speed. So in a contactor, it can take, you know, sometimes 5-6 milliseconds or longer for it to actually open, even after you command it to open. So those currents escalate in the event of a fault. In an SSPC, you can sense, naturally you do overcurrent protection, ice grid T, but you can also sense rise time of the fault current. So what you do is you shut off on rising current, so you actually never get to the levels of fault current that you see with a contactor. So it's much faster, and it's much better for the feeders, for example, won't see such a fault current transient as it would be with a contactor.
Thank you. Next question. Based on the connector amperage, is there a rough number to estimate the connector resistance, or how much loss is expected? I'm not going to try and read that formula. Based on the connector current ratings, you gentlemen can see it. I thought it was a typo. Or anyone want it?
Yeah, this is Matt. I'll chime in here. So generally, current carrying capability is dependent on many factors that we can help our customers work with. So generally speaking, wire will have a voltage drop specification on the wire, the connectors themselves, the terminations, the crimps, the interfaces. How much current you can put on there is typically monitored by the T-rise capability, and that's affected by the density of how many wires are together, how many contacts are together, what is the thermal management around it. It's generally a highly complex equation. So when we work with our connectors and our ratings, we typically do a single circuit so you know what one wire will give, and then we would do a fully populated connector so you know if you energize all at the same time at the same levels what that will give, and then we'll often do a partially populated version as well. So it is a highly complex characterization. We do it based on product, and you know, if you have specific questions on a product, you know, we can definitely help with that. But each product will have a product rating that we've done our testing on.
Thank you, Matt. I think I have time for one, maybe two questions. Would the high current cables have specifications for the maximum current density and the duration at the peak current density? Who would like that one?
Plus Bruce Connolly, I can take that one. Yes, and I mean those types of ratings are completely defined by the type of conductor that you have. There's standard tables for certain temperature rises above ambient for current carrying capability. In this modern age, though, what we oftenize are doing is we do modeling both for steady state and for transient behavior. In many of these weapons, you're going to have high transient behavior, maybe 10 times the steady state current for 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds or more for firing a cannon, say. So, yeah, this does have to be taken into consideration. In the future, there may be other exotic materials that are used in wire to raise this current carrying capability. You may have heard of CNT and such things. I can't go into that here because it's just too deep a topic. But there are things on the horizon. You have superconducting as well. And there's been a few forays into systems like that. But for the main part, the wire's been around for 100 years or more for heavy power systems. There are well-established curves for current handling capability and temperature rises.
Thank you. And that brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. I'd like to thank Carl Kitts, Bruce Conway, and Matthew Macalonis for speaking today, and TE Connectivity for sponsoring today's event. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media webcast. Goodbye.